It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
And here I thought after Zombie Backlash we'd have a quiet week. So much for that. This is episode 705 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 23rd, 2021. You know, we are now 2 months away from SummerSlam, I think almost to the day, which is when Peacock was expected to have everything back up on the network that was there before the move. And I'm not very optimistic about that happening. And their new classic content drops are getting smaller and smaller. They announced 8 episodes of Superstars from 1994 are going up in the entire month of June. 8. That will be the smallest upload of classic content in a single month since the start of the network 7 years ago. This shit is really starting to piss me off. I hate animal cruelty, but this Peacock needs to get its ass kicked. Last call, if you want to take advantage of our Amazon Music offer, we only have a couple days left. May 24th is the deadline. You can get 3 free months, 90 days free, to stream Amazon Music, courtesy of the Sound Off, when you use our link, getamazonmusic.com/solomonster. So get on that. You got a few days left. The link will still be good after that, but if you want the 3 months free, now's the time to do it. And of course, if you want a free audiobook, you can always start an Audible trial with our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster as well. Get the new Drew McIntyre book, as I know some of you have, and I thank you for that. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You can drop a $10 donation or more to get yourself a nickname and a shout-out. If you have any other questions, business inquiries, feel free to drop me a line. Thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear, Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Big Boy, Trevor McCoy, Ostentatious Alan Carter, The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Sherrod, Big Daddy Boyd, Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski, The Pastor of Pain, Damanian Ewell, Travon the Cannon Clark, who just turned 40 on Wednesday. I am very glad to hear you're doing well after the transplant, brother. Happy birthday. Many more to come. Edward Scary Very, who wants everybody to know that if you were a fan of the late Hana Kimura, you can watch the replay of last night's Hana Kimura Memorial Show, marking 1 year after her passing. You can stream that on Fight TV. I read a report about that just before I started recording here, and it sounds like, you know, a lot like the Brody Lee Show back at the end of last year. Very emotional show, especially for the people who knew Hana. Keiji Muto made an appearance. I think Kenny Omega made one as well. But it sounded like a very emotional show. So if you want the replay, Fight TV is the place to go and find it. Handsome Harold White. Check out his I See Things a Little Differently podcast and his upcoming interview with the lovely Selena De La Renta on May 24th. That's tomorrow. So again, it's called the I See Things a Little Differently podcast. And he's got Selena De La Renta coming up tomorrow. I'm jealous. We'll have more shouts from some of you guys coming up here in a little bit. I do appreciate all the support. Our friends at WrestleRumble.com are getting into the Double or Nothing spirit. Next weekend is the AEW pay-per-view. Getting into the spirit with not one but 2 AEW contests. Entries are open right now, all the way through next Sunday, for the Double or Nothing Pick'em, which is their first AEW Pick'em since 2019. So, to do it upright, the top prize is $1,000 cash. So get those entries in. And then it's the Great American Belt Bash, giving away belts to 5 different winners, including John Cena's Spinner U.S. title, the retired WWE U.S. title, the current WWE U.S. title, the IWGP United States title, and the WCW United States Championship. It's only $1 to enter. You could potentially win one of those 5 belts. Sign up right now. Between now and next Sunday, I'm going to be picking the 5 winners live on my Double or Nothing review stream next Sunday. We're going to do this up big, courtesy of our friends at WrestleRumble.com. We have got major WWE news, NXT news, AEW news, and New Japan news. So we'll start with New Japan, who announced on Thursday that its IWGP World Heavyweight title was vacated due to a neck injury to its champion, Will Ospreay. Their statement reads as follows. On May 4th, night 2 of Wrestling Dontaku from Fukuoka, Will Ospreay sustained a neck injury. As a result, Ospreay will not be participating in the next series of events and will instead return to the UK for treatment and rehabilitation. There is no timetable for his return to action at this time, and as a result, his IWGP World Heavyweight Championship will be vacated. Further announcements on the status of the title will be made at a later date. Welp, so much for CM Punk saying he wanted to wrestle Will Ospreay, and let's wait until the summer to see if he's still the champion. That pretty much jinxed things, didn't it? It really sucks for him because this was his big break. He was finally IWGP Heavyweight Champion. He only had the title since April 4th, the beginning of last month. Not a very long run, but it was showing a lot of promise to be a run that he could go on where he could just churn out all of these great matches. You know, he beat Shingo Takagi on that Wrestling Dontaku show, which apparently is where he hurt himself. They had a match of the year candidate. And he was preparing for a defense against Okada at the Tokyo Dome on May 29th before the show was postponed due to another COVID state of emergency in Japan, which is in effect through the end of this month. Okada's got his own injury problems. He's got, you know, the discs in his back are all wrecked, at least a couple of them. There's no telling how bad Ospreay's injury is. They gave us no information on it. He has not said anything specific about the injury, if he'll need surgery and how long he'll be out for. And right now, New Japan has no champion. Now, their next big show is the Dominion show on June 6th. If Okada's back can hold up, you know, he would give them stability in the top spot right now. But, you know, it's been done to death to just put the belt back on Okada. Kota Ibushi served, you know, I think as a good champion, but again, like Ospreay, not a very long run. You know, he won the championship at the beginning of the year, and how long did he have it for? You know, a couple of months? He deserved a longer run with it. He also turned 39 years old on Friday. The man is a fucking vampire. Shingo would be a great choice, but he just lost. Fair and square, he lost to the champion. I would love to see Minoru Suzuki get a short run with the belt. Why not? I feel like it's now or never. Why not? But I had this thought too. And I run this past you. I know this is not something New Japan is used to doing, but I was thinking about the G1. Do we know, by the way, if it's being delayed again to later this year? I have not heard anything. If it's being delayed again because of the Olympics or whatnot. If not, then the G1 is coming up soon. It's coming up within the next couple of months. And I think it would be really cool if this year's G1 climax was contested for the vacant IWGP Championship. The winner becomes IWGP Heavyweight Champion. That would be one way for them to raise the stakes. Make things a little more interesting. But things seem to be a mess right now for New Japan. COVID has just wreaked havoc on everything. Just when it looks like things are starting to slowly get back to a degree of normal with WWE and AEW, it doesn't seem that way with New Japan. You know, their world champion goes down with an injury. Jay White tested positive for COVID, and he's stuck in quarantine. He's the current never open weight champion. I don't even know the last time their U.S. title was actually defended in Japan. We just saw it defended on TNT. But when the last title defense took place in Japan, I couldn't even tell you. Now there's reports of unrest among a lot of the foreign talent, some of them who want out. Fit Finlay was on JBL's podcast talking about his son David Finlay possibly wanting to come to WWE and get him the hell out of Japan. It just seems like a mess, and I hope that they can sort everything out quickly. AEW Double or Nothing 3 is next Sunday from Daly's Place. They have nearly 4,000 tickets sold already with a capacity of about 5,000. I am going to be live on YouTube on Wednesday night, even though Dynamite will not be. It is being preempted to Friday night at 10 o'clock due to the NBA. I am going to be live instead at 8 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday when Dynamite would normally be going on the air. I'll be streaming my Double or Nothing predictions and probably taking some phone calls, which I have not done in a while. So if you are not watching the NBA, and frankly, even if you are, I hope that you will join me then and then after the pay-per-view next Sunday for my full recap. The big news this week, though, was Warner Media dropping a bomb on Wednesday, announcing that AEW Dynamite will be moving. Not moving nights. Still is going to be on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. But moving from TNT to TBS, starting in January of next year. They will not be off TNT completely, though. TNT is going to air 4 annual specials. So one per quarter, very similar to how TBS used to air the WCW Clash of the Champions specials. I was going to say Saturday night's main event, but that was not quarterly. Clash of the Champions, I believe, was quarterly, I think. We also have a name and a premiere date for the second AEW show, which will be a one-hour series starting out on TNT, and then it will migrate over to TBS next year when Dynamite does the same. The show will be called AEW Rampage, debuting on Friday, August 13th at 10 p.m. Eastern, Friday the 13th. Trying to get that SmackDown lead in. And the show is likely to be taped on Wednesdays on most weeks, except for pay-per-view weekends where it would air live the night before. So if you have a pay-per-view on a Saturday, you would have a live Rampage on that Friday. Now, I was not aware of this until Meltzer mentioned it. And I had one person, I think, either tweeted me or emailed me. I forgot who it was. Might have been an email asking me if it is wise for a company that has not been around for very long, if it is wise for AEW to have another hour of television. Is it too much? Is it too soon? Why is this happening? And this kind of ties into it. Now, Meltzer mentioned in The Observer this week that when AEW negotiated its new agreement with TNT at the beginning of last year, this is right before COVID hit, They wanted to expand Dynamite. And we kind of joked about it at the time because USA is the network that wanted WWE to move Raw to 3 hours. That's why Raw went to 3 hours. It was not a Vince McMahon call. It was a USA Network call. And they were going to pay them a lot of money. And so they did it. And now we've had almost a decade of 3 hour Raws. And Raw has just gotten progressively worse ever since. I mean, it's gotten worse for a lot of different reasons. But the show being 3 hours every week is an absolute chore because they don't have the creative wits about them to make a 3 hour television show on a week to week basis interesting. So it sucks. And it waters down the product when you have to sit through 3 hours every week of that show. In this case, when they were negotiating their agreement last year, TNT wanted to expand Dynamite to 3 hours every week. From 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Does this sound familiar? Tony Khan had enough, and I don't care what you think about him, but in this case, Tony Khan had enough sense to know that would have been a terrible idea. So the compromise was taking that extra hour that would have been on Wednesdays, breaking it off, and doing it on a different night, which is much better. Having a 2 hour show on one night and an hour long show on a completely different night, much better idea. But that's where this second show comes from. If TNT had their way, we would have had a 3 hour Dynamite every week. And guess what? Even if you like Dynamite, you think it's better than Raw, that would have sucked too. That would not have been a good idea. What a fucking disaster that would have been. 3 hours of any wrestling show on a week-to-week basis, not talking pay-per-views, is just too long. And it will burn out your audience. Tony Khan has learned the lessons of Monday Night Raw. Rampage is not going to be an extension of Dark, where it is filled with matches with people that most, you know, viewers may not know. It's basically going to be a third hour of Dynamite, but on a different night. So think about what Sunday Night Heat used to be when it first debuted during the Attitude Era. Sunday Night Heat used to have a lot of their bigger names on that show before that show ultimately fell off. Sean Ross Sapp at Fightful also broke the news on Fightful Select that the Full Gear pay-per-view will be taking place on Saturday, November 6th from St. Louis, Missouri, with a live Rampage on TNT the night before from the same venue at the Chaffetz Arena. Now, AEW is said to be getting a lot of money out of this deal. PW Insider said the word going around internally is that they're getting somewhere in the area of an eight-figure payday from Warner Media out of this. TBS is available in about a million more homes than TNT, so when you're talking about networks that are in 80, 90 million homes, a million more, it's basically a wash. I mean, it's not that big of a deal. The key is that it's not in fewer homes. That's the good thing. You're not moving to a channel that's going to be in 5, 10, 15 million fewer homes than where you were before. And I said on Wednesday during my stream, this is pretty much a lateral move. You know, network-wise, it's not really an upgrade, but it's not much of a downgrade either. And regarding the TNT title, Tony Khan told The Observer his plan is to keep the title, but he has a different Turner idea that he thinks is cool. And I don't know what that is, but Turner used to have a television title for WCW, which I think would make a perfect option. If they're going to make any kind of change, it would make perfect sense to just have a television title, and then you can have TNT and TBS logo side plates on the belt if you want. Brian Weitz is the general manager of TNT and TBS. This is what he told, I think he told Deadline Hollywood. Did the NHL have anything to do with it? Sure. NHL had something to do with it. NBA had something to do with it. The college schedule, the ton of preemptions. When we looked where the consumer is going to be, where wrestling fans were going to be, we want to give them the most opportunity to consume as many shows as possible. We felt TBS had an opportunity to be the network and the best platform for expansion. Oh, the NFL rights deal, or the NHL rights deal, had a little more than something to do with this. It clearly had a lot to do with this. It's probably the overarching reason why the show is moving in the first place. TBS does air Major League Baseball playoff games, so that could be an issue a few times a year. But there's nothing I've heard or have read about this week that would lead me to believe that this is anything but a plus for AEW. So if you are an AEW fan, you should be happy that Warner seems to be doubling down on them and not giving up on them. That's a good sign. As these next couple of years go on before their deal comes up for renewal. And the more content they have, it's kind of like WWE. Why does WWE produce so much content? Well, they get paid for it. But also because when it comes time for rights negotiations, you have all of these networks that they just want content. Content is king. So if WWE has 3 hours of Raw and 2 hours of SmackDown, an hour of this, 2 hours of that, you know, even if it's not good television in a lot of cases, it does bring value. AEW seems to be following the same formula. That should bode well for them in a couple of years when they either have to renew it Warner, or maybe they move and go somewhere else. But again, I don't see this as being a bad thing. So again, I'll be live on Wednesday night, a little bit earlier than usual, but when you would usually put on TNT to watch AEW, you put YouTube on instead. And we'll talk about Double or Nothing, go through all the predictions, and like I said, maybe take some of your calls as well. Then we got some WWE news. WWE made it official. They are leaving the Thunderdome and returning to live events on the road with a 25-city tour beginning on July 16th, all the way through Labor Day at the beginning of September. They were celebrating the news on SmackDown Friday night. The tour begins with SmackDown in Houston at the Toyota Center. Money in the Bank is going to be taking place on July 18th in Fort Worth. And Raw the next night from the American Airlines Center in Dallas. Tickets go on sale this Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern for anyone who wants to go. And more tour dates will be announced in the coming weeks. Sounds like the talent found out about the news the same way that we did. Xavier Woods quote tweeted the announcement by saying, "Oh, good to know that we're going back on the road." This seemed inevitable with everything starting to open up. I mean, the Matt Men podcast were the first ones about a week or two ago to mention the fact July 16th was looking like their first day back on the road. So, even before that, it just seemed inevitable, especially once AEW made their announcement that they were going to be starting up on the road, which they are. They're beating WWE to the punch by a week. Once that happened, you knew it was only a matter of time. Not that they're basing everything around AEW, but it was just a matter of days or weeks before we got this announcement. And on top of that, you know, more people are getting vaccinated and shedding their masks, and mask mandates in a lot of places are going away. So again, this just felt like it was going to be coming sooner rather than later, getting back in these different buildings. There will be a honeymoon period when they run those first shows. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to see. There's also a rumor that WWE is discussing the possibility of bringing John Cena back for that, at least that first show back in front of fans. They should be planning lots of special surprises, whether it's John Cena, whether The Rock shows up and makes an appearance to welcome everybody back, whatever it may be. They should be planning to make a big splash on those first few shows back. Make them as special as possible to get as many people to tune in. And it'll be a whole feel-good thing, you know, back on the road where we belong, back with people, actual people in the buildings at whatever the capacity may be. They should be planning a few big surprises. Sports Illustrated is reporting that SummerSlam will be held in Nevada, which very likely means Las Vegas, or Paradise, I guess. Got to be specific about it. It's like the whole Chicago-Rosemont thing. They don't want to piss off the people in Rosemont. They don't want to piss off the people in Paradise either. But Allegiant Stadium is the name of the venue that I'm seeing batted around. That's the new domed stadium where the Raiders play for football. It fits around 60,000, but it is expandable up to 72,000, which is kind of ambitious. I mean, if they're going to do it in a big stadium like that, that would be their first really big show back since all of this started. Can they get that many people in there? You know, I don't know. I had heard that they were budgeting about 25,000, 25 to 30,000 for each night of WrestleMania. And I don't believe they sold out either night. I think both nights it was in the low 20s. That was in Florida where, you know, everything has pretty much been opened up for months. So I don't know. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to want to go. You know, UFC just a few weeks ago had a show, packed building, right? I think that was in Vegas. Maybe not, but you know, can they get 60,000 people in a stadium in the next few months? I don't know if they can get 60,000, but I do think they can get, you know, probably a good 30, 40,000. You still have to put together a compelling card. I don't think just saying, hey, WWE is coming to Vegas is going to get 60,000 people in the door. They have to put together a pay-per-view with matches that people actually want to see. But having been to Vegas in July, when it was 112 outside, Vegas in August sounds like hell on earth. But I like Vegas. I'm hoping they bring WrestleMania. Actually, I hope they bring WrestleMania to Allegiant Stadium in the next few years, right? They're going to be in Dallas next year, LA the year after. And then I'm kind of hoping whichever WrestleMania comes after that, I think it's 39 maybe, right? 30 or 40. It might be 40 after that. I'd like to see them come back to Vegas. Last time they were in Vegas, they were at Caesar's Palace. 16,000 people in a little makeshift outdoor arena. That was in 1993. Now they have a brand new stadium. Vegas is a tourist destination. So I'm kind of hoping they bring Mania back there in the next 2 or 3 years. NXT. released 9 people this week, including 2 referees, but the highest profile name of the bunch, and one of the least shocking, given a lot of the drama around him. I mean, it was shocking only in how long it took to happen, was the Velveteen Dream, Patrick Clark, 25 years old and all the potential in the world, flushed right down the commode. Less so because of allegations, it sounds like, and maybe more to do with other issues, potentially, said to be related to his attitude and his behavior. We know about the allegations. Allegedly sending indecent photos to minors, DM convos asking them personal questions about their bodies. At the time, he said something to the effect of, he did not communicate improperly with anyone. There was a private photo of his that was shared without his knowledge or consent, and he was working with a third party to look into it. So he never denied that it was him, only how it ended up being shared publicly. There was an audio clip that was shared that sounded an awful lot like him asking what school one of the kids went to. He said he was only taking an interest in them because he wanted them to be successful in life. Just really bizarre stuff. Other people came out around the time of the speaking out stuff, calling him a groomer and a child predator, which are strong accusations to make against somebody. You know, when we're talking about kids, Triple H commented months ago and said everything was investigated internally and there was nothing there, even though one of the accusers claimed that he was never even contacted, not once, by WWE. But Triple H just got so sick of answering questions on these takeover conference calls, he said he wasn't going to take any more questions about it. Dream was in a car accident many months ago. Triple H said people thought they took him off TV because of the accusations, but it was really just because of the car accident. And there were a lot of questions about the car accident as well, and what happened there. And yet, for all the things that Triple H said, he has not wrestled a match, has Velveteen Dream, since December. Was he in another car accident after that that we're not aware of, that would have kept him out of the ring? How do you account for all of this time that he's had in hibernation? Did he think people were just going to forget about all the different rumors around him? That has yet to be explained. But as far as WWE is concerned, like Officer Barb Brady would say, nothing to see here, people. Move along. Nothing to see here. And yet, one of the company's biggest prospects now finds himself on the unemployment line. Very likely unemployable by any other promotion. Look at Marty Scurll, case in point. I mean, if you think Dream is just going to pop up somewhere at an indie show in a month or two, I don't think it's going to be that easy for him. But if they ever did bring him to TV, the Thunderdome would have been the best thing for him because back in front of live crowds, he would have been eaten alive. And so maybe that factored into their decision on him. Maybe they really did investigate stuff and they didn't find anything. And they just said, you know what? It doesn't matter because if we put this guy on TV in front of people, this is never going to go away. But I look at it a little bit differently and say that if WWE was worried solely about the allegations with him months ago, if that was the only thing they were worried about, then they would have cut ties with him a long time ago. Why even keep him under contract and keep the questions constantly coming if it was just about the accusations? Then they would have cut ties with this guy months ago. So there were very likely other issues at play here, and I think in due time, if there were, we'll probably find out what they were, because this stuff tends to always leak out. But it's stunning. It's a stunning fall from grace for someone who, John Cena, who for years was the face of WWE, one of the biggest stars in the history of this company. John Cena once called him The One. He was asked from NXT if he could face Adam Cole, Ricochet, or Velveteen Dream. Who would he prefer? It was at like a Comic-Con or something. And he said Velveteen Dream, and he compared it to those Star Wars movies with the Jedi who says, I think that's the one. Cena said he had an odd mental and great feeling about Velveteen Dream. Shawn Michaels once said, there's a couple of guys I'm fortunate that I get to work with because he is so young and has so much natural ability and at such a young age is so comfortable in absolutely every aspect of the job. You just got to believe that if he were to just grow at the exact same pace as everyone else at this point, being so young and as talented as he is, I just don't see how the expectations for him cannot be bigger than anything that I have ever seen. And that's coming from Shawn Michaels, who has been around the business for over 30 years, and some people would call him the greatest of all time in the ring. It is incredible to think of how high his stock was coming out of that match that he had with Aleister Black 4 years ago, where he finally got Aleister to say his name after the match was over. That was the peak for the Velveteen Dream. And now, it's dream over. What a waste. Referee Drake Wirtz, who had once ascended to the position of head referee in NXT, he was fired this week. He appeared in the ring as recently as Tuesday's NXT show. He was in the ring officiating matches, or at least one match. I just talked about him last week on the podcast, and I said he was treading on very thin ice. And he was treading on thin ice not because he has a certain political belief or whatever. He's entitled to believe whatever the hell he wants to believe. He was treading on thin ice for zooming into school board meetings backstage at the Performance Center, ranting and raving about masks while wearing NXT gear. Because he came off as a representative of NXT. You think that... I don't even care if the people in WWE, and there definitely are a lot of people in WWE who hold the same beliefs that he does. Even still, as a company, you don't want this guy doing shit like that on company time wearing company gear as if he's a representative of your company. And he had also made a lot of enemies behind the scenes with his just bizarre behavior. He was heavily anti-mask and said to be anti-vaccine, which led to a lot of NXT talent not wanting to work with him and have him referee their matches because he refused to be vaccinated. And they're absolutely right to feel that way. If they have to share the same ring with this guy. I mean, look, if that's how he feels, like I said, hey, his decision. But people should not feel forced into working with him and being in close contact with him because that's the nature of the job, right? If you're a referee, you're basically the third man in that ring or woman. But you're in the ring with these guys. You're up in their face, right? You're right there as much as their opponent is. And if you got two guys in the ring who have been vaxxed and this guy doesn't want to be, you know what? They're right to raise that as an issue and say, look, I don't feel comfortable doing this. I don't want to be in the ring with this guy. He was becoming a very vocal problem. This was inevitable. And he's already changed his Instagram avatar from him in his referee shirt smiling to him holding a giant gun, which is not surprising to me. He's already reaching out to promoters to let them know that he's a free agent, he's available to work. I don't know if that's as a referee or as a wrestler. He used to be a deathmatch wrestler, so maybe he wants to go back and do deathmatches. Who knows? But again, like I said, this was probably the least shocking of all of these. Other cuts include referee Jake Clemens, Alexander Wolf of Imperium, Skylar Story, the former Brandi Loren, who had not yet debuted on TV. In fact, she only just signed with WWE in October. And I think hers may have been the most brutal of the bunch when Shotzi Blackheart tweeted that last weekend she helped Brandi move into her brand new apartment. And not even a week later, she had to move out and is leaving Orlando because she got fired. That sucks. Vanessa Bourne is gone. She was moved to the Raw roster many months ago. You would never know it because she never debuted and she was never used. Kavita Devi, who is an import from India, trained by the great Kali, she had a first-round match with Dakota Kai in the first Mae Young Classic a few years ago that has over 62 million views on WWE's YouTube channel. That has got to be the most watched match of Dakota Kai's career. I'm sure it is. But that's the power of the Indian market. Even at the time when the match first went up on their channel, it had 10 or 12 million views at that time. It's like, what the hell? I mean, it completely outperformed every other video they had put up. And I checked, and all these years later, 62 million views on a random, not even very good, first round match with two women at the time. Even Dakota Kai, I don't think, was really very well known. Certainly not to the, well, I mean, to the WWE audience, she was. And Kavita Devi, nobody knew hardly anything about her. 62 million views. But I guess she had gone home to India to tend to a family matter. There was no indication if or when she would be back. And they weren't doing anything with her, so they cut her. Jessamine Duke, one of the four MMA horsewomen. We never did get that match. She seemed to be more interested in streaming and gaming for WWE's Up, Up, Down, Down channel, which does belong to WWE. Xavier Woods clarified that this week. It is not his channel. It is their channel. They just let him use it. But I guess she's done. She's still going to be streaming on Up, Up, Down, Down. But she will not be a wrestler anymore, at least not for them. And Ezra Judge, a former arena football player and bodybuilder. I saw pictures of this guy. He is in incredible shape physically. No idea if he could work a lick because we've never seen him in the ring before. But a report from Fightful said that he nearly came to blows once with Drake Wirtz over some of the things that Drake had said that could be taken as offensive. I don't want to say what they were because I don't have them confirmed. And I guess things nearly got physical, so some people online are hailing him as a hero. Well, he may be a hero, but he and Drake have one thing in common. They're both unemployed. Now, Alexander Wolf is kind of surprising because he's been involved in a storyline on TV recently. He was just beaten down by Imperium this past Tuesday on NXT. He spoke with the website Sport One and had this to say about his release. I got a call from WWE on Wednesday and was told that my contract was not extended. It was not officially a dismissal because my contract expires on June 15th. From then on, I am no longer a wrestler for World Wrestling Entertainment. The reason I was given was the pandemic line that savings are still necessary due to the global event restrictions. Well, that's better than no reason at all, but ultimately, you know, WWE makes so much money that no firing is really mandatory. But it is what it is. The machine continues to run. The parts are replaced. I see that's the business. I am proud of what I achieved. I know I could have achieved more, but in a league like WWE, you don't have everything in your own hands. You have to control what you can control. I don't think I can blame myself in that regard. And he said that his plan is to move back to Germany rather than stay in the US. But yes, that is the reason they gave most of these folks budget cuts. Instead of just saying, we don't see any real value in you, we'll just blame it on budget cuts. Here's an idea. Maybe don't sign so many people if you don't know what the fuck to do with them. Let's get to some more of your PayPal shoutouts. Wilfredo, what's going on? Wilfredo Pandemonium Flores. Check out his buddy Tyler's new Patreon, where he does movie reviews and music covers, as well as original music with his experimental rock group Infant Fist. What a name. Infant Fist. Visit patreon.com/musicandmovieman. Rock Hard, Russell Segee. He plays in a band called Bazooka Sharks. I love these band names. This is fucking great. Bazooka Sharks. That's sharks with a Z. And they have a new song called Nowhere. You can find a studio session performance of them singing the song on the Bridge City Sessions YouTube channel. Just type in Bridge City Sessions and the word Nowhere should be one of their most recent uploads. If you like your music hard and loud, having listened to this song, then this is the song for you. This ain't no nursery rhyme. Bridge City Sessions on YouTube. The band again is Bazooka Sharks and the song is called Nowhere. That's a fact. Chris Foster, thank you for the support. He has a YouTube channel called Factsma. It's F-A-C-T-S-M-A. It's always good to ask questions, and in these videos, they try to analyze various subjects in the hope of gaining a new understanding of familiar concepts. So they ask basically new and different questions with the hopes of expanding our knowledge about things that we already know and expanding our minds. They have videos like, are you born with arachnophobia? In my case, in my case, the answer is no. Funny enough, my arachnophobia comes from the movie Arachnophobia. I was fine with spiders until I saw that movie. And then I was very much not fine with spiders. So in my case, I can answer that right now. I was not born with arachnophobia. But that's one video. The evolution of the human diet is another example of a video. What does Wi-Fi look like? That's a good question, actually. I have no idea what Wi-Fi looks like, only that it better work, or I'm getting a wire. New videos are out every Monday. Just search for Facsma on YouTube. That's F-A-C-T-S-M-A. And finally, American-made. Alex Jimenez works for a pest control company in Florida called Commando Pest Control and Trappers. They handle animals safely and humanely, and they can take care of whatever problem you may have. I thought the bugs here in New York were bad. I find insects I didn't even know existed whenever I'm down visiting someone in Florida. But what's interesting about this is the company is owned and operated by a gentleman by the name of Sammy Roman, formerly known as Kid Romeo from WCW, a former WCW Cruiserweight Tag Team Champion with Elix Skipper. I love that on their website, the first thing you see is Sam dressed in a tactical vest with a replica belt slung over his shoulder, ready to catch some vermin. So if you have a pest control problem, visit CommandoPestControl.com. You should go to the website anyway. CommandoPestControl.com. Or you can visit Commando Pest Control and Trappers. That's all one word on Instagram. You could see Sam's Instagram page. He's got all kinds of cool photos and videos on there on the job. He still looks like a beast. He looks like he could get back in the ring today if he wanted to. So I certainly would not want to be an insect going up against this guy. The latest update from Keith Lee was in response to a fan on Twitter. This is kind of our every now and then Keith Lee update here. It's a fan asking him, basically, what's next? And Keith Lee said, good question. Unfortunately, only time will tell, my friend. They're not just holding him out for creative reasons. There is clearly something wrong. And I hope whatever it is, it's not too serious, and he overcomes it, and he comes back better than ever. And I think beyond that, it would be wrong to speculate any further than that. But I hope everything works out. After being eaten by zombies at Backlash, The Miz was not on Raw the next night, which I was happy to hear and happy to see. I thought, well, they at least had enough common sense to keep him off the show. It sounds, though, like it had more to do with the fact that he suffered a knee injury. It is believed to have been an ACL tear, which is no bueno. WWE has not yet confirmed the injury. The question is it a partial tear where he would not need surgery and he could be back in a couple of months? Or is it a full tear, which would mean surgery and a long layoff? That we don't know. Miz has been around for a long time. Mid-2000s. And in that time, I cannot remember him suffering any kind of serious injury. I mean, I'm sure he's had bumps and bruises and minor things, but I cannot recall a time where The Miz suffered a tear or a broken something and was out for 6 months and needed major surgery. Because he does not wrestle a very hard style, but he's still a wrestler. Look, I think I have to defend Miz a little bit on this, because I see that criticism of him a lot, and I do think it is valid. When you compare his in-ring style to that of a lot of other people on television, a lot of other people in other companies, Miz wrestles a very safe style. If you were to ask me to define what is a safe style, there is no one singular definition. I just know that when I watch The Miz, the word that comes to mind with a lot of his offense is soft. and he's very cautious in what he does. He doesn't take any real major risks, which is good. Good for him. There's a lot of dopey people who take a lot of really stupid risks, unnecessarily, and then people will wonder, why is this guy hurt all the time? Gee, I wonder. So good on Miz if he doesn't want to do dives and do all these stupid things that everybody else does. But when you watch him just in a basic match, his offense is very soft. He is not a guy that goes in there and wrestles what you would consider to be a strong, stiff style of a match. And he's not an aerial guy. So for those reasons, he has been able to largely stay healthy. But if you are a wrestler, even if you wrestle a softer style, and you're not doing moves off the top rope and dives out of the ring, it's still dangerous. Anybody who climbs into a ring and wrestles is taking a risk and putting their body on the line. And injuries are inevitable. And in this case, it sounds like the injury happened on Damian Priest coming, I think, off the top rope and landing on his knee. So it wasn't even something that Miz himself may have done. It may have just been bad luck. And his opponent fell on him in a way where he just hit the wrong spot at the wrong time. And shit happens. Sometimes it's out of your control. You could be the best driver in the world and never have an accident and be driving down the road and some schmuck who's drunk plows into you. You could be doing everything right. Sometimes, though, it's not on you. You've got to trust the other drivers on the road. And if you're a wrestler, you have to trust your opponent to take care of you. But shit happens. Mistakes happen, and it sounds like that's what happened here. So Miz has never suffered a serious injury in his career outside of being eaten by zombies, which I would consider to be pretty serious. So being eaten by zombies and tearing your ACL at the same time, that just sounds very cruel. I guess zombies don't actually eat ACLs. I wonder if they taste like chicken. It's been several weeks now. Adnan Virk is terrible in his role. I'm sure he's fine as a sports announcer, commentator, whatever else it is that he does, talks baseball. I'm sure he's a nice guy. He is a terrible play-by-play guy in WWE. He is not getting any better. He is supposed to be the lead voice on Monday Night Raw. He may have a longer leash because of who got him the job. He's a Nick Khan guy. But I would be shocked if he is still there by the end of the year. We had Bobby Lashley and MVP issuing an open challenge to anyone not named Drew McIntyre or Braun Strowman who was not there. McIntyre was there. He was out there asking for another shot at the championship. His challenge was, Bobby's that is, was answered at the end of the show by a former WWE champion in Kofi Kingston, who had already wrestled Randy Orton earlier in the night. So I guess this was their way of trying to throw us off and swerve all of us. Kofi has been pulling tag team duty ever since his singles push ended in 8 seconds at the hands of Brock Lesnar. So to say that this was quite the letdown at the end of the show would be an understatement. Mace and T-Bar, they had a promo backstage later in the show where they did a coin flip to see which one of them would face Bobby Lashley in the open challenge. And then, outside of one appearance they made during a lumberjack match, they were never heard from again. Sheamus and Damian Priest also either teased accepting or flat out accepted the open challenge, yet they had Byron Saxton out there on commentary right down to the wire right before the final segment wondering who will accept Bobby Lashley's open challenge. Well, maybe if he watched the show, he wouldn't have to ask such a stupid question. So earlier, Kingston pinned Randy Orton with a roll up after Orton was distracted by Xavier Woods playing the trombone outside the ring. Xavier Woods has been playing the trombone on television now for about 4 years, maybe longer. Let's call it five. 5 years of this. All of a sudden, this is a distraction for Randy Orton. He lost via trombone distraction. That was the finish. He was distracted by a musical instrument. And in the main event, McIntyre grabbed MVP's cane out of his hand when he was about to use it on Kofi, and Drew hit Lashley with it instead. The referee's back was turned, and again, Kofi won with a roll-up. And I see some people hyping Kofi Mania 2. Like, this is some big renewed push for Kofi Kingston that they've been waiting for. Let us recap. Okay? Shall we? Let us recap. Xavier Woods plays his trombone. Kofi rolls up Orton on a fluke distraction win. McIntyre hits Lashley with a cane. Kofi rolls up the champion on a fluke distraction win. And you honestly want me to believe that this is the beginning of Kofi Mania 2 and that Kofi Kingston should be challenging for the WWE Championship or even getting a second run with the belt? Are there people who actually believe that this is going to happen? Please tell me that you are not serious. Drew McIntyre was still front and center on this show wanting to challenge for the belt. That is going to be your Hell in a Cell match next month. Whether it's in the cell or it's just on the pay-per-view, that is going to be the match in June. It is going to be Drew McIntyre yet again against Bobby Lashley. Kofi is probably going to get a title match out of this because he pinned the champion, which I fucking hate. But if he gets that match, it's going to be on TV in the next couple of weeks, and he will lose. This is not Kofi Mania 2. There is no Kofi Mania 2. It does not exist. There will not be a Kofi Mania 2. Kofi Mania was an organic thing that the fans drove 2 years ago. It culminated in a really nice moment of WrestleMania. And Kofi had 6 months as the WWE champion. And then WWE showed you what they really thought of Kofi Kingston as the WWE champion. I agree, he deserved a better fate than what he got in the end. But it's over. They could start building him back up if they want to, but that's not what they're doing here. This is not about Kofi. It is clearly about Drew. And I knew it would be because he didn't take the losing fall of Backlash. So there's their out for him. Well, he didn't take the losing fall. Braun Strowman took the losing fall. So therefore, he deserves another match. Even though Drew McIntyre lost at WrestleMania. Fair and square, one-on-one, he lost. And even though he wasn't pinned in the triple threat match, he still lost. This is not a hard concept. You're in a match, you don't win, then you must be a loser. But this is what happens when you don't have any other believable baby faces built up for the spot. You keep going back to the same well. It's like they did this with Batista many years ago. I want to say like 2006 on SmackDown, to the point of just comedy. How he just kept getting shot after shot after shot until he eventually won it. And then at that point, it's like, well, what's so impressive about this? If you gave me 10 title shots, you know what? I'm probably going to find a way to win at some point. Be a lot more impressive if I only had one or two. If I had two and I couldn't get the job done, guess what? It's time to move on. But they don't have anybody else. And I understand whatever's happening with Keith Lee is probably something that's out of their hands, or maybe it's health related, whatever it may be. But we shouldn't just keep coming back to, well, there was Keith Lee and now he, you know, he's not available. So what? They should have had 3-4 other people ready for a spot like that, and they don't. Damian Priest, you could go with him. It still feels very early, though. I wouldn't go to him so quickly. But they don't have anybody. So, of course, they're going to keep coming back to Drew McIntyre. You go back to the same well over and over and over again until the fans get sick of it, and they're going to turn on Drew. Believe me, they are going to turn on Drew McIntyre. AJ Styles, he lost a singles match by DQ to Elias. Two heels in tag teams against one another. I don't know if this means that AJ and Omos have gone babyface or not, but this was a complete waste of time. Natty and Tamina, they retained their women's tag team titles over the former champs Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler. After Alexa Bliss walked out on stage with her doll Lily, and suddenly Pyro shot out from one of the ring posts while Shayna had Tamina in the Kirifuda clutch. After the Pyro shot off, she, of course, released the hold, and she peered over at Reginald outside the ring. Reginald had been standing on the ring steps. He was sort of inching his way into the ring to interfere. And when the pyro went off, I mean, it was nowhere near him, but he sold it like he was blinded by the fire. This led to Shayna being distracted and pinned. This was garbage. I will become Lily's number one fan if the doll for her next magic trick can make Nia Jax disappear. If she can do that, I will become Lily's biggest fan. Sheamus got his revenge on Ricochet for stealing his hat and jacket at Backlash the night before with a win in what was the best thing on the entire show on Monday. Sheamus is really one of the unsung MVPs of this show the past several months. In the ring, anyway. That bro kick, by the way, that he hit Ricochet with looked vicious, especially when they showed it in slow-mo. It looks so great. Asuka got a rare win over Charlotte Flair with what else? The WWE special, a roll-up, or an inside cradle, I guess it was in this case. There is a difference. I guess inside cradle is a form of a roll-up, but you gotta distinguish roll-up, schoolboy, inside cradle. I mean, I guess they're all interchangeable, I guess. This match had some rough moments. I liked the Sheamus Ricochet match more. But the question is, now what? I thought they were going to go right into Flair and Ripley one-on-one, but they gave Asuka the win here. So it just feels like we're going in circles now. We had another lumberjack match with Damian Priest, this time with John Morrison, who I guess, unlike The Miz, was not eaten by zombies. The Viking Raiders, Mansoor, Nikki Cross, Mace and T-Bar, Akira Tozawa, Shelton Benjamin, Cedric Alexander, the Lucha House Party, Titus O'Neil, and Mustafa Ali all surrounded the ring, and here I thought we were done with the fucking zombies. Now we get the Raw zombies. Instead of their bodies, it's their careers that are dead. Priest won, and then after the match he said it's time to move on from the Miz and Morrison. It was time to move on from the Miz and Morrison 6 weeks ago. And then he said, maybe I would accept Lashley's open challenge, which of course he never did. And I already mentioned the open challenge stuff earlier. More of the same from Monday Night Raw. It's hard for me to even say that this show is any worse than it usually is. You know, this show has a few fleeting moments. I mentioned the Sheamus stuff with Ricochet. But again, largely, the other 2 hours and 40 minutes of this show, it's just a fucking bore, man. It is a fucking chore to sit through. I am hoping that somehow getting fans back in the building will somehow light a fire under their crotch and will get them to make some changes to this show. But I keep saying the same thing over and over again year after year. And I am not foolish enough to think that this is going to be any different. We'll have a little honeymoon period. And I'm telling you, within a month or so, if that, it's going to be right back to the same old shit. Only this time, the people in the stands will have a voice. And if they don't like what they're seeing, they can make their voices heard. That is the biggest difference leaving the Thunderdome. We don't have a real lead on what's over and what's not. We've been relying on Vince McMahon and Bruce Prichard to tell us what they think and who they think is over, what's working, what's not working. That is a dangerous thing. That is a very dangerous thing. At least now, we will have actual human beings in these buildings. And they will be the ones to dictate what they like and what they don't like, what works and what doesn't work. And no matter how the creative is, that is a good thing. Now over on SmackDown, Sonya Deville introduced a parade of champions, which was just all their champions except Roman Reigns, standing on stage with their belts. Paul Heyman walked out. He entered to Roman's old theme music, the Shield music, which I thought was a nice touch. The idea that only the champion is worthy of his new dramatic theme music. But he basically came out to explain why Roman was not going to be there. And he shouldn't be. Roman should not be standing out there with these other jabrones who are beneath him. He's in a league all by himself. When he comes out, it's a parade of one. He should not be one of four or five different people standing on stage. Bayley was out to protest Bianca Belair's win at Backlash since she used her ponytail, which brought Belair to the ring, and Nia and Shayna out to attack Bianca from behind. This led to Bayley, Nia, and Shayna against Natty, Tamina, and Bianca. They explained Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler being on the show by bringing up the dumb brand-to-brand invitational rule that they dust off every now and then. Baszler got a win for a change. She tapped out Natty with the clutch. They've announced a rematch for the women's tag team titles on Raw tomorrow night. So after getting the match last Monday, we are getting it again. We are getting it again this Monday. Why are Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler even together anymore? I mean, they were reluctant partners to start. They made it work because they were the champions, and then they lost. And then they lost the rematch. And yet they're still together, and we're getting another match. Why? Why are these two still together? Why is Shayna Baszler still tied to the hip with Nia Jax and Reginald? We had the SmackDown debut of Rick Boogs, who has been largely hidden away at the Performance Center since 2017. He made one or two appearances on NXT at Full Sail doing the guitar gimmick. He's all full of energy. He's got a ton of charisma. So he had that one appearance, I think it was, and then he was never seen or heard from again on TV. But there he was on SmackDown. He was playing the guitar, and Boogs said that he was there to rock out with Shinsuke Nakamura, and he played him down to the ring with Nakamura sporting Baron Corbin's crown upon his head. The two had a match, and stop me if you've heard this before. It ended with one of the competitors being distracted by a musical instrument outside the ring and getting rolled up and pinned. They did the same fucking finish 3 times in 1 week across Raw and SmackDown. It's nice to see Boogs, at least. His act got over pretty big the one time they let him do it on TV. But does it get any lazier than that? Repeating the same, not even good finish, repeating the same dumb finish 3 times in 1 week. And there are people who actually think that these people put all of this great thought and effort into what we see on television every week. I'm sure there are some people who do that, and then their work gets crumpled up into a ball and thrown in the waste paper basket. This is the creative prowess of the biggest wrestling company in the world. It also looks like we're going to get a feud over the crown, and not necessarily another King of the Ring tournament. Xavier Woods is not going to be very happy about that if they don't bring back King of the Ring. He has been desperately, for years now, hoping to be part of one of the King of the Ring tournaments. In fact, he just changed his Twitter handle to Future King of the Ring. Looks like he may have to wait a little bit longer. Jimmy Uso was lobbying Sonya Deville for a tag team match this Friday with the Usos against the Street Profits, which she granted. Jey Uso was not happy when he found out that Jimmy didn't consult him first before getting them the match, and he said, well, I gotta check with Roman to let him know first. And Roman was not happy when he found out. When Jey said we to Roman in reference to, you know, we, me and my brother, Roman said, we is you and I. So they're teasing that the Usos may not be on the same page going into that tag team match this week. We had an in-ring promo with Roman Reigns, Jey Uso, and Paul Heyman, which I thought was very good. And Heyman, the best part about this was Roman called himself a humble man. And he said, I don't like to brag about myself on live television. So instead, I'm going to let my advisor, Paul Heyman, do it for me. And Heyman seemed surprised by this development. He was very excited. He thanked Roman for the nice little surprise. And, you know, Heyman pointed out that Roman sent The Fiend over to Raw. He pinned Kevin Owens. He made history when he pinned Daniel Bryan and Edge at the same time at WrestleMania. Heyman noted that Edge has not even been back since WrestleMania. Roman ended Bryan's career. He sent him into a Bella retirement. He said that it is a career highlight to acknowledge the tribal chief, and he noted he would do anything for Roman. Oh, I believe it. I believe that, you know, if you got him some pillows for his knees, oh yeah, he would definitely do whatever you wanted him to do for Roman Reigns. He would do it. And he asked Roman, what would you like me to do for you next? And Roman said, "I want to see my cousin." And Heyman yelled for the timekeeper or the ring announcer, whoever, "Go get Jimmy Uso. Get Jimmy Uso out here." All of a sudden, Cesaro's music hits. He comes out with his arm in a sling. And he said, "You know, I was in the back looking for Seth Rollins, and I heard this annoying talking and screeching, and so I came out here." And he challenged Roman Reigns to a rematch for the Universal title at Hell in a Cell, when all of a sudden Seth Rollins jumped him again, like he did at the pay-per-view after the match. He attacked the arm. He gave two curb stomps to Cesaro, who did a stretcher job. I liked Rollins was wearing another one of his ridiculous outfits, but it was this colored suit that was all full of skulls. I liked that. I'd like to know where I could buy that one. As a matter of fact, I would wear that on one of my own streams. Anything with skulls. I thought that looked cool. So if anybody knows where I could pick up something like that, let me know. But we had a nice little tease here of a Reigns-Cesaro rematch. If it happens, it'll be on television. You know, again, he beat Cesaro fair and square. There's no need for a rematch, but they did three of them with Kevin Owens. So if they wanted to get a second match out of Cesaro, absolutely they could do it. But it's going to be on television because at Hell in a Cell, it's going to be Rollins and Cesaro. And it looks like they're planting the seeds for Roman Reigns against Jimmy Uso. Now, we already had one Uso challenge Reigns inside the cell last year for the championship, and it looks like we may soon be getting another. Dominic Mysterio picked up a singles win over Bobby Roode with a frog splash. I'm gonna say, this is me kind of booking things out here. The next team in line for a tag team title match, and it works out because they're a heel team, and Rey and Dominic are baby faces, probably going to be the Alpha Academy. That's a match I'd like to see. I think Alpha Academy against the Mysterios in a one or two match program could be fun. In the meantime, the Usos go work with the Street Profits. And that way, they can save the Usos match with the Mysterios for SummerSlam. I like the idea of doing that match and maybe doing a title change at SummerSlam. And SummerSlam, you know, it's a few months away, but it's not as far away as it kind of feels. You could do that. You can have Rey and Dominic go ahead and work with the Alpha Academy. The Usos have their own little story going with Roman. They're going to wrestle the Street Profits. You can hold off on that match, on doing the Usos and the Mysterios. Save it for SummerSlam. SummerSlam, especially if they're doing SummerSlam at a big stadium, possibly. You're going to need some big matches on the show, and that would be probably the biggest tag team title match on that brand right now that they could do. The main event was a fatal four-way for the Intercontinental title, with Apollo Crews defending against Big E, Kevin Owens, and Sami Zayn. Kevin Owens was on the bump this week, and he was asked about how are you feeling going into this big main event coming up this week on SmackDown, and he had an interesting answer. He noted that he's not against being the Intercontinental Champion again, but if he went into this match on Friday and did not win the title, he would not be upset. And he said, "As everybody knows, Owen Hart had a very positive influence on my career. I was a big fan of his. I named my son after him. My wrestling name, Kevin Owens, is obviously a tribute to my son and to Owen Hart. And what some fans have pointed out to me in the past is that me and Owen share a birthday. We were both born on May 7th, but also what's cool is that we were both Intercontinental Champions twice. And if you add the total amount of days from both of those reigns, we have the exact same amount of days as Intercontinental Champion as well." And I thought that was a very cool thing. Yeah, that it means enough to him that he almost doesn't even want to be the champion again just because it just matches up so perfectly. And he doesn't have to worry about it because he's not the champion. He did not win, but this match was total nonstop action. See what I did there? I thought just a really fun main event. Big E went for the big ending on Sammy. Kevin Owens hit a super kick to Big E. Then he hit one to Sammy. Hit a pop-up powerbomb on Apollo for a near fall. Zayn took out Owens, knocked him on out onto the floor. In the ring, Big E caught Sammy with a Uranage and hit the big ending on Apollo Crews. when Commander Aziz pulled Big E out of the ring to break up the fall, Big E sent Aziz into the ring post. And when he jumped back into the ring, all of a sudden the lights started to go out. And a plume of smoke filled the aisleway. We couldn't see what was going on. We couldn't see who was coming out. All of a sudden, out from the smoke comes Aleister Black. And Apollo Crews grabbed Big E by the leg while he was distracted. Big E was trying to fight him off. And while this was going on, Aleister got into the ring and he hit Black Mass. With Big E going down, Apollo got the pin. He retains the Intercontinental title. So we are headed for a Big E Aleister Black match very soon, which takes him away from the IC title for a while. And maybe all titles, because, you know, instead of possibly grooming him to challenge Roman Reigns, maybe it's SummerSlam, if he's feuding with Aleister Black, Aleister Black needs to win. After being gone for so long, he can't come back and lose. So I don't know where that leaves Big E when this little feud is over here, assuming he does lose to Aleister Black. But it is good to finally have Black back in the ring on TV. One question I have, where is Mia Yim? Because there were reports a few weeks ago that she had been, and I think she's listed on the SmackDown roster now on the website, I believe. She was shifted over to the SmackDown brand, and she was set to debut a few weeks ago. So I don't think it's a case of whatever's going on with Keith Lee, she's taking time off with him because they're together. It sounded like she was ready to make her debut a few weeks ago. Plans changed, and her segment got nixed, but that was at least 2 weeks ago. And she still has not been seen or heard from. So where the hell is Mia Yim? NXT this week. It was good to see Toni Storm back to her winning ways with her win over Zoe Stark. That new finish that she used looked sick. It was like a hip toss float over into an implant DDT. I don't know what she plans on calling it, but people online pointed out that it looked an awful lot like the Ruby Cutter that British wrestler Dean Allmark created, and for good reason. He helped train Toni Storm and said that she asked for his permission to use the move, which, of course, he granted. And he said she didn't have to do that, but it was a respectful thing for her to do. He gave her his blessing. I hope she keeps it because I think it looks great. They aired one of their great Prime Target videos that they do for big matches. They did for Finn Balor against Karrion Kross, which takes place this Tuesday for the NXT Championship. They included comments from Pat McAfee and from Paul Heyman, who said the match was too close to call. It's very simple. If Karrion Kross and Scarlett are bound for the main roster, then he loses the title this Tuesday. If he's not, if he's staying right where he is, then he wins. He retains, and Finn Balor probably goes up. It's very simple. Jake Atlas got a win over Cameron Grimes, but it was kind of an afterthought. Before the match, Grimes threw it to a video package showing clips of Ted DiBiase losses and embarrassing moments from his career. So we saw DiBiase losing in the finals of the tournament of WrestleMania 4 and being DDT'd by Jake the Snake at WrestleMania and being slopped by the Godwins or Henry Godwin and all of these different moments. Then when Cameron Grimes was getting ready to hit the cave-in and win his match, DiBiase's music hit. Out he walked onto the stage for the distraction, which led to Cameron Grimes being pinned. Grimes ran out of the building to DiBiase's limousine outside, and DiBiase rolled down the window and told him, "You did good, but you're no million-dollar man." And he cackled, and he told the driver to take off. Let's go. Let's get out of here. This Tuesday, the two of them are going to have what they're calling a million-dollar face-off. I still like the idea of IRS showing up to collect unpaid taxes on Grimes' money, and he goes broke and then ends up having to work for the million-dollar man. We had Arash Markazi interviewing Pete Dunne, sit-down interview. He asked Pete who's next for him in NXT. And Dunne said that he already beat Kushida. He can beat Walter whenever he goes back to the UK. And he could take on Karrion Kross if he wants to. Talked about how he never has a bad match. Even when I lose, my opponents leave not feeling you know, great, and they're very different than they were when they first went in. And Markazi said that Dunn reminds him of UFC fighters. And Dunn talked about how he blended the UK style with a lot of other styles from around the world. Dunn conquered NXT, and now it's time to go after the NXT championship. I thought Dunn was good here. He is not a natural public speaker. Promos are actually his weakness, I think. I mean, when you compare it to his in-ring ability, his promos are absolutely his weak point. But I thought he did good here. This did not sound scripted the way the WWE promos normally do. It felt like an interview with a fighter. If Markazi, and I assume this is why he used him for this segment, because he does stuff like this. They brought him in for the purposes. He did this with Adam Cole, right? Sit down interview poolside a few weeks ago, where it's like he's interviewing a fighter. That's what this felt like. Later in the show, Mackenzie Mitchell interviewed Bobby Fish, who said that he was out with a triceps tear after being hurt in the War Games match. He's coming for Pete Dunne. He's coming for Oney Lorcan. So they're setting up, if not a tag team match, where maybe he can convince Kyle O'Reilly to, you know, team with him. Then they're setting up for a singles match with Bobby Fish against Pete Dunne. And that should be a win for Pete Dunne, because it looks like they're building him up for something much bigger than just Bobby Fish. They're building him up for chicken. They're building him up for some prime rib instead of fish. Killian Dane beat Alexander Wolfe, who was then promptly attacked by his fellow Imperium members, Fabian Aichner and Marcel Bartel. Kicked out of Imperium and right out of the company. That's rough, because he got the call the next morning telling him that he was not fired, but again, they're not going to extend his current contract. So that's a double whammy for the guy. Legado del Fantasma beat Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher with an assist from the grizzled young veterans who attacked Ciampa outside the ring when the referee was not watching. Raul Mendoza, he got his nose or his lip, I think it was his nose, busted open on a forearm early in the match by Ciampa. This would be the final match that Drake Wirtz would ever officiate for NXT. They made him work one last time before kicking him to the curb. Let's get our money's worth out of this guy. Legado del Fantasma will get a tag team title match in 2 weeks against MSK. We had Ashanti, The Adonis, and Top Dollar making their debut in tag team action as part of the new Hit Row faction with a win over Tony Nese and Arya Daivari. Top Dollar was showing off his strength. He was throwing these boys around. Adonis showed off his short fuse, where even Top Dollar had to hold him back at one point and tell him to chill out. Hit Row cut a promo after the match. I'm loving this new group so far. And Bronson Reed is your new NXT North American champion, beating Johnny Gargano in a fun main event, fun steel cage match. He had a fight off Gargano and Austin Theory to get the job done. But he hit one splash off the ropes to Gargano's back and then climbed up to the top turnbuckle and hit the big tsunami splash off the top rope for the win. I thought maybe they would go all Rikishi and Val Venus on us for the finish with a splash off the top of the cage. But they have that black grate or whatever it's called on top of the cage that helps lift it up and down. So I don't even think it would have been possible to do that. You know, when Rikishi did it, or beat, like a steel beam, whatever it is. But when Rikishi did it, he didn't have that issue. Still one of the greatest things I've ever seen. My stomach was in knots watching Rikishi slowly inch his way across that beam, holding on to nothing. And Rikishi was a big boy. I don't know legit what his weight was at that point, but if he wasn't 400 pounds, he was definitely somewhere in that 350 to 400 range. Not holding on to anything. 15 feet up in the air, very slowly trying to make sure he keeps his balance so he can get right to the middle of the beam. And then diving off the cage. It's like a roller coaster, right? The worst part of a roller coaster, especially if it's a really high one, and I've been on a few, even though I'm afraid of heights, for me, the scary part is the slow ascent, because all you can do is sit there and your mind just starts to run away. The worst thing in the world is that It gives you time to sit there and think. But you're all, you know, belted in. You can't go nowhere, right? You're committed to it. You're going up and you're going down, and there ain't a damn thing you can do about it. And you look off and you're just going higher and higher and higher. And then you get to that top point and you level off and you know that steep drop is coming. And then, of course, the drop itself happens. To me, that's what makes it so terrifying. That's always the scariest part to me of a roller coaster ride. That's kind of what that was like. You knew Rikishi was going to jump off and do a big splash, right? That was the big drop. But watching him inch his way over like that and not fall, and fucking kill himself or kill somebody else, to me, that was the scariest part of that entire thing. I don't think that bump gets enough love. Like, I don't see them using it in video packages or in the open to the show. To me, that's a spot that's worthy of being in the opening signature. Maybe they just don't want Val Venus on television because he's a fucking whack job. Maybe they don't want to put him in the opening video. But I'm happy for Bronson Reed. I've been a fan of his for a while. I think he's a really good big man worker. A good worker, not just the big man worker. And there's a few potential challengers lined up for him now. I could see Pete Dunne being built up for a North American title match. I could see Swerve Scott not only being built up for one, but winning the North American title. My only question is, I wonder, you know, with them going back on the road with the main roster shows and getting back in front of fans in actual arenas, I wonder, because I have not heard anything, if they have any plans to return to Full Sail now that things are opening up again, or if they plan to stay at the COVID Coliseum for good, because they took that space in the Performance Center and they turned it into their own little arena, you know, with the screens and everything. And they have some people. They can't fit as many people in there as they do at Full Sail. Full Sail, they could fit about 400, I think, 400 to 500 people. I think right now, you know, at the PC, they get maybe, I don't know, 100, 150. But I've heard nothing about them returning to Full Sail. So I wonder if it's just not in the plans yet, or if they just like their new dig so much that, you know, maybe the days at Full Sail are over.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, 116 years ago this week, we're taking it so far back I can feel the hair on my head touching my ass. At least I think that's my hair. On May 19th, 1905, it was just a few weeks ago I mentioned George Hackenschmidt beating Tom Jenkins in Madison Square Garden to become the first man recognized as the world champion in wrestling. Well, Frank Gotch was at the show that night challenging both men, but he said that he would wrestle Jenkins regardless, win or lose. Jenkins was the American champion at the time, and he agreed to put his title on the line against Gotch on this date at MSG in a match that lasted a ridiculous 2 hours and 15 minutes. Altogether, Gotch and Jenkins wrestled a series of 9 matches together, and this was match number 6. According to a great write-up by Steve Yoey at Wrestling Classics, the match did not begin until 10:30 that night. And things got nasty between the two men. Jenkins put Gotch in a stranglehold that the referee, who was also a baseball umpire, did not realize for several minutes was an illegal hold. And after he broke it, Jenkins simply reapplied another one. He reapplied the move again. Gotch protested to the referee a few times, stalling the match. He allegedly bit Jenkins on the arm at one point. It got nasty between these two. One reporter said by the end of the first fall, 1 hour and 27 minutes into the match, it looked like Gotch had basically gassed out. Looks like he had basically tired himself out so much he could barely do anything. The second fall started at 12:04 in the morning. Late in the fall, both men took a nasty spill out to the floor. And Gotch won the second fall in 36 minutes to tie things up at 1 apiece. And in the third fall, Jenkins pinned Gotch in 11 minutes with a full Nelson. Gotch's people argued that the city of New York and the appointed referee had ripped him off. It was the New York City screwjob, I guess. They had their 7th match 1 year later on May 23rd, 1906 in Kansas City, this time with Gotch winning the title 2 falls to 1. with Jenkins taking the first fall in 26 minutes, Gotch winning the second fall in 14 minutes, and the third fall in 17 minutes. After Jenkins gave a speech telling the crowd of 6,500 that he lost fairly and that Gotch would be the champion for a very long time. A long time turned out to be 7 months. And when Gotch died years later, he was only 39 years old. Jenkins lived to a ripe old age of 84. 58 years ago this week, on May 17th, 1963, Bruno Sammartino won his first WWE Championship, defeating Buddy Rogers in just 48 seconds at Madison Square Garden, kicking off what would become, and still is to this day, the longest title run for any champion in company history. Over 7 years, 2,803 days. Fabulous Moolah was women's champion for longer, but much of that came before there was even a women's title in WWE. Rogers claimed that 6 weeks before the match, he suffered a heart attack and he was in the hospital even as late as 5 days before the match. But by golly, he wanted to be a man of his word and make sure he dropped that title. Bruno had a very different take and said the heart attack story was concocted by Rogers to make himself look better, as he was not very happy about losing. He said the commission doctors ran all kinds of tests on Buddy, but could not find anything wrong outside of him complaining about chest pain. And for the record, there are match results for shows as little as 2 weeks before this MSG match that list Buddy Rogers as wrestling. So the idea that he was in the hospital for 6 weeks and only crawled out of his hospital bed a few days before to do this match, a little suspect. Bruno admitted that he did tell Rogers, as legend has it in so many words, once they got to the ring that night, "We can do this the easy way, or we could do this the hard way." 48 seconds later, Buddy Rogers chose the easy way. 31 years ago this week, on May 19th, 1990, RoboCop rescued Sting at WCW's Capital Combat pay-per-view, dubbed The Return of RoboCop, as part of a promotion for the release of RoboCop 2. Oh, God. Sting was injured, but they advertised him for the pay-per-view anyway. So he gets jumped by the horsemen, locked in a shark cage, so that RoboCop can rip the door off the hinges to free him. And the horsemen had to back away from RoboCop out of fear, so watching Arn Anderson and Sid back away from RoboCop is quite the sight. Also on the show, Mean Mark beat Johnny Ace in Ace's final televised match in the United States. With All Japan cutting its ties with the NWA, he chose to keep working in Japan until he retired. And by the end of that year, Mean Mark had found work as an undertaker for Vince McMahon. 29 years ago this week, on May 17th, 1992, one of the greatest matches in WCW history took place. This made my list of the top 15 matches in WCW history. Sting's Squadron. Sting, Barry Windham, Ricky Steamboat, Nikita Koloff, and Dustin Rhodes defeated the Dangerous Alliance, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, Stunning Steve Austin, Larry Zbysko, and Bobby Eaton in a War Games match at WrestleWar 92 from Jacksonville, Florida. This is probably the greatest War Games match that I have ever seen. It included 7 WWE Hall of Famers, including Medusa, who was outside the cage with Paul Heyman. The Dangerous Alliance did not last as long as they should have. They were feuding with Sting at the time. He was the world champion. Nikita Koloff entered last for Sting's Squadron. They played up whether or not he could be trusted. Sting was down in the corner, and Nikita reached down to pull him up. Sting looked skeptical. As they were talking, Anderson and Zbysko went to attack Sting from behind, and Nikita shoved Sting out of the way. He took the bullet for him. Neither Jim Ross nor Jesse Ventura on commentary brought up the fact that it was exactly 1 year ago before this that Sting and Lex Luger wrestled the Steiner brothers at the first ever Super Brawl. In that match, Nikita Koloff ran down with a chain that was intended for Luger, but Sting shoved Luger out of the way and Koloff hit Sting with it instead, which cost them the match. So here, they basically repeated the spot, but it was Koloff saving Sting. So a nice little bit of of continuity there, except that Ventura couldn't understand why Sting and Koloff were teasing some kind of beef. They're partners, aren't they? That's what he said. And JR never pointed any of that out to him. You know, if he wasn't there for it, which I don't think Ventura was, Jim Ross could have pointed it out to him, and he never did. But this match is well worth going out of your way to see if you've never seen it before, and if you have, watch it again. It's great. 28 years ago this week, on May 17th, 1993, one of the more famous episodes of Monday Night Raw aired live from the Manhattan Center with two memorable moments. First, the Kid, who they had also referred to on television as the Lightning Kid, and I believe the Kamikaze Kid, pinned Razor Ramon in the biggest upset in WWE history. It is the match that made Sean Waltman a star on the national stage and gave birth to the 1-2-3 Kid. He had a tryout match. He never thought he would actually get hired because at that time, how many people were WWE hiring that looked like Sean Waltman? Not many. They'd bring in guys like him to do jobs for, you know, $300, but that's about it. So he never thought he would actually get hired. He gets a call one day from Vince McMahon, who runs, I think Pat Patterson was on the line with him, and he runs this entire scenario by him. He goes, "We're going to bring you in for a few weeks to do jobs, but we're not bringing you in to do jobs. We just want people to think that you're on television to do jobs, but then we're going to give you this big shock win on television over Razor Ramon." So he worked job matches against Doink and Mr. Hughes for a few weeks. Neither of those guys were aware of the plan, so they treated him like they would any other job guy at the time, which only made it that much more shocking when he eventually won. But Vince and Pat laid everything out, even right down to the rematch they would have, with Razor putting $10,000 of his own money on the line if the Kid would accept his challenge. He told them that, he told the company that he had a tour of Japan. And they said, "Well, no problem. We'll just have, you know, we'll have Razor cut promos on television each week, upping the dollar amount until you finally accept. And then you'll come back and we'll do the match." And that's exactly what they did. But the main reason they were doing this, it wasn't really because they had big plans for Sean Waltman. It was to begin the Razor Ramon babyface turn. And Waltman says the same thing. That's really why they came up with this idea. Now, if they can make a new guy in the process, even better. But that's really why this was done. It was more for Razor than anything else, to give Ted DiBiase a reason to start making fun of him on TV. Later in the show, Marty Jannetty returned out of the crowd in a disguise to confront Shawn Michaels in the ring and accept his open challenge to a match for the Intercontinental title. Jannetty had last wrestled Michaels for the title at the Royal Rumble, and he was fired immediately after, allegedly for being under the influence of alcohol or drugs or both during their match. Jannetty has claimed that he was just really tired, and he blamed Shawn Michaels for starting that rumor. But here he was back, and Mr. Perfect walked out during the match to get a closer look. He ended up throwing a towel in Sean's face, which caused him to stumble backwards into a small package or some kind of roll-up, and Jannetty won the title, which he would not hold on to for very long. The following month, he dropped it at a live event to Michaels, who had some help from his new bodyguard who debuted that night, his insurance policy by the name of Diesel. So you can say, with Michaels losing to Marty, Kid beating Razor, and then Diesel debuting a few weeks later, this was a big period here for the Click. Speaking of the Click, 25 years ago this week, on May 19th, 1996, the night of the infamous curtain call incident at Madison Square Garden, which was captured on film by two fans who snuck a video camera into the building, like they always used to do whenever they would go to the shows back then, Jason Cosmides and Manny Mattotti. Were it not for them breaking the law, that incident never would have seen the light of day. It was the final WWE appearances that night for Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, their last appearances with the company for the next 6 years. Both of them were headed for WCW. fans in the building that night, a lot of them, they knew that it was their final night. They were serenaded by alternating chants of "You sold out" and "Please don't go." Triple H, back in his Hunter Hearst Helmsley days, pinned Razor Ramon. Goldust was still out with a knee injury, so Helmsley was the substitute for him. Hall grabbed the microphone, the house mic, after the match, and WWE officials in the back panicked, and they cut the mic, not knowing what he was going to say, which was just, "Say goodbye to the bad guy." And in the main event, Shawn Michaels beat Diesel in a steel cage to retain the WWE title. After the match, Michaels kissed Diesel, who suddenly sprung to life, as if Michaels was breathing oxygen into his lungs. And the two of them hugged in the ring, which was a no-no back then. You did not do that in front of the live audience. You didn't embrace your opponent like that publicly after just wrestling them. One being a heel, the other being a babyface. I mean, it seems kind of silly now because wrestling is silly. I mean, wrestling these days is treated like a joke. It's like a Broadway show. But back then, that was a no-no. They were then joined in the ring by Razor and Helmsley. All four men embraced. I think the kid was, I don't know if he was out hurt or he was on a tour of Europe, but he wasn't there. A lot of people in the back were less than amused by this entire thing. Among them, Vince McMahon, Bruce Prichard, Jerry Briscoe, Jim Cornette, and Davey Boy Smith. Bret Hart, who was not there that night, but obviously he found out about what happened. He was not happy. Shawn Michaels claimed that he asked Vince McMahon about it beforehand, but things just got out of hand. And the axe had to fall on somebody to make a point. They couldn't touch Hall and Nash because they were leaving. Shawn was the champion, so it all fell on Helmsley, who admits that he was going to win the King of the Ring tournament the following month. And instead, he jobbed out to Jake Roberts in a qualifying match. And the crown went to Stone Cold Steve Austin, who cut his famous Austin 316 promo that night, which made him and the company a lot of merch money. Highest-selling t-shirt of all time, I think, wrestling-wise. But I do think the impact of this on his career, Austin's that is a little bit overrated. Austin would have been fine had he not won King of the Ring. It's one of those what-if questions I've gotten a few times over the years as like a mailbag question. What if? What if Triple H had won King of the Ring? What if Austin didn't win King of the Ring in 96? And sometimes people forget, you know, it was not the King of the Ring that made him a megastar. He didn't even make the main card at SummerSlam that year. He wrestled Yokozuna on the pre-show. It was his rivalry with Bret Hart. Him calling out Bret in the fall. Bret coming back to the company. Them facing off at Survivor Series. And then feuding into the beginning of 97 all the way through WrestleMania and even beyond WrestleMania. Those matches, that feud, is what put Austin on the map and got him acceptance as a main event star. And if it wasn't Austin 316, it would have been some other catchphrase, but, you know, he still would have been champion and he still would have ended up as the top babyface in the company. He just may have ended up with a less cool catchphrase. Vince McMahon told Triple H if it was anybody else, he would have fired them. But he wasn't going to do that. He said he was going to start him back at the bottom. He told him, "You're going to have to learn to eat shit and like the taste of it. You're going to have to eat plates and plates of shit." And he did for many months. He did jobs on TV. He did jobs on pay-per-view. He didn't win a pay-per-view match until the following year, although he did win the Intercontinental title in October. And it gets lost in the noise of the curtain call that night, but there was also a title change on this show. The Godwins beat the Body Donnas to win the tag team championship. 22 years ago this week, on May 23rd, 1999, Owen Hart fell to his death from the ceiling of Kemper Arena in Kansas City at the WWE Over the Edge pay-per-view. As far as wrestling tragedies go, you've got the Benoit tragedy where three people senselessly lost their lives in brutal fashion. And you have Owen Hart. And it doesn't get any worse than that. The Owen thing will stay with me for the rest of my life. And if you knew him personally, if you were a family member or a friend, I just can't even imagine what that must have been like. As senseless and as unnecessary as it gets. That's the thing that really bothers me about the Owen thing more than anything. It didn't have to happen. It wasn't as if he was in the middle of a match and it was a botched move, he broke his neck or something like that. This did not have to happen. I talked extensively about this when I covered his Dark Side of the Ring episode, which you can find elsewhere. He was doing the Blue Blazer gimmick at the time, and he was scheduled to win the Intercontinental title from The Godfather on this show after making a bumbling superhero-like entrance from 80 feet up. The idea was that his harness would, as it's lowering him, when he's almost down on the mat, it would stop maybe 5 feet, 5 or 6 feet off the ground, and he would just kind of hang there for comedic effect, trying to unhook himself. Instead, there was some sort of malfunction. He plummeted to his death while the video package for his match was airing on the Titantron. Thankfully, we didn't see it happen live on the air, but people in the building did. He came very close to landing on referee Jimmy Corderas in the corner, and had that happened, we would have had two deaths instead of one. Jim Ross, after being told in his ear by Kevin Dunn that he was going to have to give viewers the update on Owen, told Dunn, "Kevin, I don't know what the update is. Nobody has told me anything." And Dunn told him, "JR, Owen's dead." And then he started counting him down. 10, 9, 8, 7. And JR had to deliver the news to all of us moments after being told that Owen had passed away. Vince McMahon made the decision to continue the show and not tell the live crowd what had happened. Undertaker beat Steve Austin in the main event to win the WWE title, but honestly, who cares? Nothing else even matters on this show. 21 years ago this week, on May 21st, 2000, WWE held its Judgment Day pay-per-view from Freedom Hall in Louisville, Kentucky, featuring two excellent matches and the return of The Undertaker as the American Badass. Chris Benoit retained his Intercontinental title over Chris Jericho in a submission match. And Triple H beat The Rock 6 falls to 5 in a 60-minute Iron Man match to win the WWE Championship. This is my favorite of all the Iron Man matches that WWE has ever done. This was nonstop action with a hot crowd and a memorable finish, even if it was botched. Undertaker had been out since September after healing up from a groin injury and then a pec tear that he suffered in January when he was about to come back. That was an accident lifting in the gym when Crush, Bryan Adams, who was supposed to be his spotter, wasn't paying attention. He was chatting with somebody else, not realizing that this weight had fallen on Undertaker's chest. So that delayed his return by a few months. And maybe if he comes back in January and not May, maybe there is no American Badass. We may never know. But he rode down to the ring on a motorcycle to Kid Rock's American Badass with about a minute left in the match. He got in the ring. He wiped out all the members of the McMahon-Helmsley regime. People went nuts for this. They forgot all about the countdown clock. Nobody was counting down. They were so into The Undertaker. He chokeslammed Triple H before the time expired, which Shawn Michaels, the guest referee, did see. He apparently was not supposed to see that, but he was staring right at it. But there were 4 seconds left on the clock, and somebody in the truck had the smarts to take the clock off the screen. But another 6 seconds or so went by with Undertaker scooping up Triple H for the tombstone. Then the buzzer went off right before he hit the pile driver. Then he dropped him. Then Shawn Michaels called for the bell. They clearly ran out of time. The original finish, per the Wrestling Observer at the time, was to have been Rock just having enough time to crawl over to try to make the cover, but then time would run out on him before the referee counts three. Which, if that happened, Rock, as the champion, should have retained the title by the rules if they were all knotted up at 5 falls apiece. So I don't know how they would have explained that one, if maybe Rock was supposed to actually retain. I don't know. Michaels awarded Triple H the decisive fall by DQ on outside interference by The Undertaker. Despite the fuck-up on the timing, this was chaos. I loved everything about this. 20 years ago this week on May 21st, 2001, one of the greatest matches in Monday Night Raw history aired, and it sucks that it will never be talked about again. It is lost to history when Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit beat Stone Cold Steve Austin and Triple H to win the WWE Tag Team Championship. This was the match where Triple H, in breaking up the walls of Jericho on Austin, tore his quad muscle in his leg, which is an excruciatingly painful injury. He gutted out the remaining minutes of the match, including being put in the walls of Jericho on the announce desk. And then after an errant sledgehammer shot to Austin, he got tackled to the floor. Austin was pinned. This came after Triple H lost on television to Jeff Hardy. He lost to Kane at the Judgment Day pay-per-view the night before. He lost his IC title. Clearly, they were building to a breakup of the two-man power trip, because they went from having all the titles to only Austin having a title. And I don't know if the plan was for Triple H to go babyface right away and challenge Austin for the title at the King of the Ring, or if they would have held off for SummerSlam, but that was the plan, for Triple H to go babyface and to challenge Steve Austin for the championship. It was not originally for Jericho and Benoit to challenge Austin for the title, which is what they were forced into. You know, Triple H going down really screwed up their plans, and he ended up missing that entire WCW invasion period. It was bad, you know. They turned Austin heel at the same time, and that did a number on business and ratings. So they turned him heel at the same time they knew Rock was going off to Hollywood for a few months to film a movie. It's like, well, we'll turn Austin heel, but at least we have Rock. No, they knew Rock was going away. And then once Triple H got hurt, they had already played the Undertaker and Kane card the month prior, so Jericho and Benoit were all they had left. It put them in a real hole in terms of top babyfaces. 19 years ago this week, on May 19, 2002, the first pay-per-view under the WWE initials, Judgment Day, saw Stone Cold beat Ric Flair and Big Show in a handicap match, which would be his final pay-per-view match until the following February. A little over a week after this show, Austin called into WWE's Bite This Internet show and was a little too honest about what he thought of WWE creative at that time. Kevin Kelly brought up the quote-unquote internet rumors at the time that Austin was unhappy with the company, expecting Austin to debunk the rumors and put them to rest. But instead, Austin did just the opposite and fanned the flames, saying that the bottom line is that everything sucks. He said he's not happy with the direction that he or the company is going. The writing has been piss poor, and he thinks it could be a hell of a lot better, but it's been pretty shitty. He hasn't been happy since before WrestleMania. Kevin Kelly asked if he thinks changes will be made to improve things, and Austin said, who knows, he's still happy to be part of the company, but creative could be a hell of a lot better than it is. Can we just take that Austin quote and just transplant it here into the year 2021? Because I think that you could argue the same would apply even today, at least on the Monday Night Raw side. Not surprisingly, days after this, Austin is booked to lose to Brock Lesnar in a King of the Ring qualifying match on Raw, and instead he walks out on the company. But also on this Judgment Day pay-per-view, Edge beat Kurt Angle in a hair-versus-hair match and shaved what was left of Kurt's hair off in an excellent match. I think this was the match that really put Edge on the map as a singles player. They had a really good match the month before at Backlash, but I thought this one was much better. Well, not much better, but it was better. Triple H beat Chris Jericho in a Hell in a Cell match that saw referee Tim White take a bump into the side of the cage and suffer a dislocated shoulder. It was serious enough that he did not referee another match until WrestleMania 20, 2 years later. And it was on the final three count of that match between Chris Jericho and Christian at WrestleMania that the same shoulder went out on him again. And that ended his officiating career. He never refereed another match again. And Undertaker won the undisputed title from Hulk Hogan in a terrible main event ending Hogan's one-month nostalgia run with the belt. There was a chokeslam spot in this match that is so bad, you really need to just see it for yourself. 18 years ago this week on May 18, 2003, after 7 months of being inactive after it was unified with the World Heavyweight Championship the previous October, that was when Triple H beat Kane during the Reign of Terror. The Intercontinental title was reinstated in May of 03, and a new champion was crowned in a battle royal on the Judgment Day pay-per-view, with Christian last eliminating Booker T to win the title. They never should have been unified in the first place. Mr. America beat Roddy Piper, who was fired the following month after an HBO Real Sports interview aired that had been taped months earlier, and it did not paint WWE in a very positive light. So he did the interview, then he got rehired by WWE. This was the run with him and Sean O'Hare. And then once the interview actually aired, they saw it and they said, "You're out of here." And Brock Lesnar retained his WWE title over Big Show in a stretcher match. This was my favorite of all the matches those two had. I thought they made good use of the stipulation. And this was a really good match. 15 years ago this week, on May 19th, 2006, WWE's first theatrical film, See No Evil, starring Kane as serial killer Jacob Goodnight, was released. He was a serial killer who collected eyeballs from his victims. One critic called it just your basic slasher fare, where a horde of horny teens riddled with contemptuous attitude wind up in the lair of an axe-happy psycho. You say that like that's a bad thing. The movie may have been no good, but the marketing on WWE television was quite clever, incorporating the May 19th date into Kane's storyline, where the mere mention of the date would just set him off into a fit of rage. 15 years later, I mean, look, people still remember May 19th. They still joke about it every year. It's Happy May 19th Day. The movie made $18 million on an $8 million budget, so it turned a profit at least, and went on to make an astounding $45 million in DVD sales in just 7 weeks. This eventually led to a direct-to-DVD sequel many years later, the aptly titled See No Evil 2, starring Kane and the new Scream Queen herself, the lovely Danielle Harris, a favorite of mine. I met her at a Q&A she did once for a screening of the movie Hatchet 2. 11 years ago, on the May 17, 2010 episode of Monday Night Raw from Toronto, Bret the Hitman Hart defeated The Miz with the Sharpshooter in a no-disqualification match to win the WWE United States Championship. He took no bumps. He had some help from the Hart Dynasty. This would be Bret's first title, and I believe his last, since winning the WCW title in 1999 and having to forfeit the title due to injury, which then led to his retirement. I love it. One last title win for Bret in Canada. A week later, after being appointed the new general manager of Raw, his first act was to vacate the U.S. title. So he was never beaten for it. He was never beaten for the title. 10 years ago this week, on May 21st, 2011... Sinclair Broadcast Group purchased 100% of Ring of Honor from Kerry Silken. Sinclair at the time served 58 television stations in 35 markets across the country. Today it's 193 stations in over 100 markets, making them the second largest television station operator in the United States. The announcement stated that their current front office staff, including Silken, Sid Eich, and Ross Abrams, would remain with ROH, while Hunter Johnston, Delirious, would handle matchmaking, and Jim Cornette would remain as executive producer in charge of talent and sharing matchmaking duties with Delirious. By the next year, Cornette was gone. 6 years ago this week, on May 18th, 2015, NXT champion Kevin Owens made his Monday Night Raw debut, answering John Cena's United States Championship Open Challenge. This was 2 weeks After Owens' former friend turned foe, Sami Zayn also answered Cena's open challenge in his hometown of Montreal and tore his shoulder, waving his arms around like a crazy man during his entrance. He got a little overexcited. Well, I mean, they were in Canada, and they had Bret Hart there to introduce him, so you can understand why he would be all amped up. He wrestled the match anyway with one bad wing. And here, Owens cut a promo on Cena, but never wrestled. Instead, he laid Cena out with a pop-up powerbomb to set up a match at Elimination Chamber that he won. 2 days later, NXT held its TakeOver Unstoppable event from Full Sail University, which saw an excellent women's title match with Sasha Banks retaining over Becky Lynch, and Sami Zayn against Kevin Owens ending in a no contest. They worked his shoulder injury into the match. He did all he could. He was very limited in what he could do. It would be his last match before having shoulder surgery. This was the NXT debut of Samoa Joe, who walked out to confront Owens to end the show, debuting new theme music that absolutely did not fit his character. Thankfully, they had enough sense to change it. I don't know what they were thinking when they put it together. They kept the intro, which was fine. But once the main beat kicked in, it sounded like the fucking main menu music from one of their 2K video games. 4 years ago this week, on May 21st, 2017, hell froze over when the modern-day Maharaja, Jinder Mahal, claimed his first and only WWE Championship with a win over Randy Orton at Backlash, becoming the 50th man in history to hold the WWE title. It was a big enough deal in Canada that his name was brought up that week in a meeting of the Canadian Parliament in Alberta, where he was born. And Jinder at that time, he had transformed his body just physically. He looked completely different. Clearly this got the attention of Vince McMahon, who decided to pair him off with the Singh brothers and give him the big push, although more so because this company was just desperate to find a big star to market in the Indian market. That's really why they did this, most likely. One of the most shocking title wins in company history. Jinder held on to that thing for 6 months. Not even Shinsuke Nakamura could beat him for it. And 1 year ago, on May 23rd, 2020, Japanese wrestling star Hana Kimura committed suicide at the age of 22 after ingesting a lethal dose of hydrogen sulfide. She had posted images of self-harm on social media after receiving hateful messages online for an episode of the reality show Terrace House, which has since been taken off the air, that she appeared on. There was a scene that manufactured some drama, as most reality shows do, which makes this even sadder, the fact that she was doing stuff on the show that was heavily embellished for the sake of television, but people watch this and they think it's real. She had slapped one of her housemates when they washed their clothes without first taking out Hana's outfit that was in there that she had worn for a match, I think her first match in the Tokyo Dome, and ruined the outfit. I believe the episode had already aired months earlier, but it was replayed and she got deluged with hateful messages like, "You have such an awful personality, is your life worth living?" and "Hey, hey, when will you die?" Police charged one Japanese man in March with cyberbullying her, but he did not stand trial. Instead, the court fined him 9,000 yen, which is the equivalent of $80 US. They charged a second man in April, who explained his actions by saying that he was simply joining in with the mob. He was joining in with what he saw others doing. He was just piling on. Hana's mother has started a nonprofit organization called Remember Hana, which works to spread awareness of cyberbullying. Fight TV just aired a Hana Kimura tribute show this weekend to mark the one-year anniversary of her death. I will never understand what possesses people to target other people directly on their own social media account, because they want to make sure these people see it. So this isn't just going online and saying something mean about somebody. This is going directly to their Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatever it might be, and saying the kind of things that they say to them. what kind of gratification does it give you to do something like that? I just don't understand it. And that is this week in wrestling history. Let's take a few mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Sean, in Detroit, Michigan. I recently listened to Jim Cornette's podcast about Shawn Michaels and his A&E biography. He mentioned that while HBK was out, he was getting paid by Vince McMahon, and once he stopped getting paid, his back seemed to heal miraculously. I always thought it was odd that he had this injury and returned better than ever. Do you think it was legit, or is Cornette just being negative? Well, that is true, by the way, that Shawn was paid. I remember reading something like he was being paid $15,000 a week, something like that, while he was out with the back injury, because WCW was still around, they were still a force, and they didn't want him to go sign with WCW, so Vince was not, you know, interested in, you know, allowing that to happen. And then when WCW was bought by WWE, I don't know when he was stopped, you know, from being paid, or if that's even true, if he was no longer being paid. I guess that's what Cornette says. He was working for WWE at that time, so maybe he would know. But yeah, they did not want Shawn Michaels, even an injured Shawn Michaels, going to WCW, so they kept paying him, and he was being paid a pretty penny to sit at home and I guess just enjoy retirement as much as he could and try to heal up from his injuries. But let me first say, I will answer your question, but this was a good opportunity for me to go ahead and just do a quick review. I did watch the A&E bio on Michaels. I thought it was very good. They spent more time than I thought they would talking about his drug use and all of the cocaine that he used to snort. I especially love the reenactments of the rolled up dollar bill and the coke and the mirror and everything. I thought that was a nice touch. You can't really tell the Shawn Michaels story without addressing all of that. They completely skipped over the fact that he was married once before. His marriage to Whisper the Nitro Girl came later on. But in his book, he talked about it. You know, if you watch this, you would think that in the late 80s and the early 90s, he was just a single guy sowing his oats. But he was actually married. But another takeaway is that it was Marty Jannetty who really was the one when they first met who corrupted him. Because they talked about how Shawn Michaels was this very, I don't know, introverted, but he was shy and he was very awkward with women and stuff, and his whole life was just wrestling and he really wasn't involved in any kind of negative shit. And then he linked up with Jannetty and they became tag team partners, and that's when the partying and the drugs and the drinking and all that started to really become very prevalent. So, you know, basically the documentary all but blames Marty Jannetty for getting him involved in all of that stuff, hitting the party scene. And Marty, who was interviewed for this, is looking very rough these days. Vince McMahon, speaking of rough, he was interviewed and really didn't add anything of any value. And it's a shame that he doesn't remember, I'm sure he just doesn't remember much, because if he had a memory like Undertaker does, when Undertaker did the Broken Skull sessions both times with Steve Austin and was out there making the media rounds promoting his documentary, and even in his documentary, his mind is very sharp. He actually remembers a lot of stuff from his pre-WWE career, specific matches and events from his WWE career. Because you would understand, a guy who's been around as long as he has and has worked with all the people he's worked with and, you know, out on the road drinking every night and stuff, right? Drinking his Jack Daniels. Maybe the guy's not going to remember every little thing, but his memory is actually really good. And it's a shame, because if Vince McMahon had a memory like he does, of all the people to write a book or to do a long Broken Skull session, sit down with Steve Austin, Vince McMahon's would be the one that I would be the most interested in, if I thought he would actually tell the truth and not just his version of what the truth is. The truth as he sees it, which is very different. But on these specials so far, when we've seen him interviewed in little sound bites, he speaks in these vague generalities that don't really add anything. They did cover Montreal. Thankfully, they kept it brief. We had Undertaker repeating the lie that they had to get the belt off Brett or else he might have showed up on Nitro with the belt the night after, which was never going to happen. They could have mentioned the fact that they had signed the WWF champion. But Brett was not going to show up on Nitro with the belt. He was not going to send the belt to Bischoff. Legally, it was not going to happen. But I am sure that Vince McMahon convinced all of them in his rah-rah speech backstage, you know, at Raw the next night that, well, this could have happened, and for the good of the company, we had to make sure that it didn't. But I thought the most compelling stuff was hearing Triple H describe his routine every night when things were really bad and they were together as DX, and Shawn was doing all the stuff that he should not have been doing. He would have this nightly routine. When they were on the road, he would have to put Shawn in his hotel room bed in a certain position off of his back so that he wouldn't choke to death on his own vomit, as other people have done. I think that's what happened to Louis Spicoli, in fact. And so he would make sure he was positioned either face down, I think, or on his side, and he would wake up. Triple H would wake up every 2 or 3 hours to make sure that Shawn was still breathing, to make sure that he was still alive. He was a babysitter, is what he was. He was like his caretaker. We had an Undertaker. Triple H was the caretaker. Undertakers, they just care about death. Triple H's job was to make sure this guy stayed alive. They talked about the night of the Raw Nitro simulcast when Shawn showed up in no condition to perform. I talked about this in the history segment a few weeks ago. They didn't get into the funny story from Jericho's book. The doink story where Jericho was coming out on the show that night. This was during his feud with William Regal. And Jericho was waiting. He was standing in the gorilla position. He was about to do a run-in dressed as Doink the Clown. And Shawn Michaels is just completely fucked up. And he's standing there at the gorilla position just looking at Jericho like, what do they have you dressed up as Doink? Like, he was really upset because he thought Jericho was great and he had all this potential. And look at these guys. They don't know what to do with you. They gave you the Doink the Clown gimmick. And Jericho is just like, no, it's just for one night. I'm just doing a run-in. And it was like in one ear and out the other. Shawn wasn't even hearing him. Oh, this is bullshit what they're doing to you. And it's like, I mean, it's not funny, I guess, when you consider the state that he was in. But it's pretty fucking funny. I always, that Doink story just fucking made me belly laugh when I first read that the first time. But that happened the same night. And I think what ended up happening is Shawn was found passed out in Vince McMahon's office, and that was it. They told him, get out of here. Get the hell out. I don't know what they had planned for him. There were rumors of him having an involvement maybe in the Undertaker Triple H match at WrestleMania. Maybe he was going to be a referee. Whatever they had planned, they told him, go home. And Shawn was not happy. He felt Triple H didn't have his back or you know, ratted him out or whatever. And there was a confrontation where Shawn went off on Triple H and was yelling at him and was probably cussing at him. And Triple H said he gave it right back to him. So they got in a shouting match and Shawn left. And the two of them didn't speak, I think, for over a year after that. It put a real strain on their friendship. So they talked about that. And that was on what was supposed to be this big celebratory night, right? We beat our competition in the big simulcast, and it was basically ruined because Shawn Michaels was acting like a complete jackass in the back. And then they got into his finding religion and quitting all of the pain pills cold turkey. Didn't go to rehab or anything. He just stopped taking his pills and knew that he had to make a change in his life, and he turned over a new leaf. It is very much the tale of two lives and the tale of two careers when he came back in 2002. So I didn't see this as any kind of hit piece like the Macho Man's was in some ways, because Shawn was interviewed for this and he was very open about all of his problems. I mean, that was probably the biggest difference. One guy is dead, the other is still alive, and he can speak to a lot of these things, and he was very open about, yeah, I was doing all of this stuff. Absolutely. It was pretty much controlling my life for a number of years. But then by the end, the episode, the documentary ends up being this story of redemption. They intersperse clips of him from the beginning of the special all the way to the end, coaching at NXT, building to a ladder match at one of the TakeOver shows last year. I think it was TakeOver 30 for the North American title. Now, to Sean's question, Sean from Detroit, not Shawn Michaels, about the back injury and Jim Cornette. And I didn't hear what Cornette said, but he implies here that Cornette is at least insinuating that the back injury was either faked or it was made out to be worse than it really was by Shawn Michaels. I do believe that he did have back surgery. And there were newspaper articles in the San Antonio press around that time that I dug up to prove that he was operated on. Some people seem to think he went away after WrestleMania 14 to have back surgery. That was not the case. And this isn't from the newspaper stuff. This is just, I thought this was common knowledge. He did not have back surgery right away. When he left after WrestleMania, he went home to rehab naturally without surgery. And he showed up on television in the summer. I was there in the building that night when he made his first appearance after WrestleMania. He did commentary. And so he was on TV a little bit. But it was not until the beginning of 99 where the decision was made, because I guess his back was not healing naturally, that, okay, now you need to go have back surgery. He tried rehabbing it on his own. It didn't work. And so they did that angle on TV in early 99 where it looked like DX had laid him out in the parking lot. Remember that? He was laid out. He was all bloody and everything. They did that to explain him being taken off TV because he was going to have his back operated on, which was to fuse his fourth and fifth vertebrae. And they also did a bone graft. Dr. Pablo Vasquez and Dr. Thomas Kingman were the ones who operated on him, and they said that he would never be able to return to the ring again because it would put too much pressure on the remaining discs in his back. They said his life would quite literally be in jeopardy if he returned to the ring. Everybody heals differently, is all I can say. Not only did he come back, he came back to wrestle full-time for another 8 years, and he did so at a high level. That flies in the face of what his own surgeons told him that he would be able to do. Now, Shawn Michaels would tell you that it was a miracle. It was a miracle from God. Whatever you believe, he did have back surgery, and you don't undergo back surgery just to fool people, or undergo back surgery and then have your doctors go out publicly and lie for you about your prognosis. I think he gave people good reason to doubt him at that time based on his past history. I can understand why someone like Cornette would think that maybe this isn't on the up and up. But in this case, do I believe it was legit? Yes, it was legit. Neil from Chicago just wanted to throw an idea out at you with the return of NXT in your house. How would you feel about a boiler room brawl between Dexter Lumis and Johnny Gargano? I got this question before Gargano lost his North American title on Tuesday to Bronson Reed, but my answer is the same. I mean, I'm not really a fan of it just because it's a stipulation that really makes it made sense for Mankind. Because Mankind used to hide out in the boiler room. I mean, when have we ever seen Dexter Lumis in a boiler room? It's like doing a casket match without Undertaker or maybe Kane. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I know there were casket matches in some of the territories long before the Undertaker was a thing. In fact, Dusty Rhodes, I think, may have been in one of the very first ones. They called it a Texas death match, coffin match, or a Texas death coffin match or something. But to me, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, if you want to tie in the in your house theme and say, well, it's in your house, one of the rooms in your house is a boiler room. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could do that, I guess, but I just don't see the need for it to specifically be a boiler room match. Tay from DC, you often cite the 1992 Royal Rumble as your favorite, but I don't believe I've ever heard what you thought about the show as a whole. Maybe I missed it or can't remember the episode. What did you think about it? It is not one of the better top-to-bottom Royal Rumble pay-per-views that they've ever done, and I've never said that it is. That would probably go to 2000, maybe 2001. Probably I think 2000 maybe. Top to bottom might have been my favorite Royal Rumble pay-per-view. Or what I think is the best top to bottom Royal Rumble pay-per-view. But the undercard, the main thing, the main takeaway was Rowdy Roddy Piper winning his one and only singles title in WWE. Now, many years later, in 06, I think, he and Ric Flair won the tag team titles, which probably saved Piper's life because that's how they discovered his cancer. I think he had, was it lymphoma, I think he was diagnosed with. But as far as singles gold, you know, he was never a singles champion in WWE until that night, and he put the Mountie out with the sleeper hold, but it was just this great moment, and he looked so happy, big smile on his face, holding up the title, and he looked good with it. He looked good with the Intercontinental title. So that, to me, is the biggest memory, the most memorable moment from the undercard of that show. Everything else on the show that night was completely forgettable. It was not at all the best undercard for a Royal Rumble show, but it was the best Royal Rumble match. And Rafael from Santiago, Chile, he's been a listener for 5 years now. I was wondering, on a personal note, what does it mean to you to know that so many people from different parts of the world, with different languages and cultures, listen to you as part of their weekly routine? Also, WrestleTalk uses Ultra Chats on their YouTube streams. That way, YouTube does not take a mandatory percentage of the money that people donate to them. Have you heard about this system, and would you consider using it on your streams? I have not heard of that. I don't know what Ultra Chat is. This is the first time I'm hearing about it. Super Chats are easier. I just think it's easier for people. And yeah, YouTube takes a cut. YouTube takes a 30% cut of everything. But I just think it's an easier system. But I mean, I'll look into it. I've just not heard of it before. As far as how does it make me feel knowing that there are people from all over the world? I mean, I think I've said this before. It's crazy to me when I get messages from people, and I love getting messages from people from these different parts of the world. I think I've gotten messages from people from just about everywhere, from the Middle East, from Africa and South Africa and Latin America, Mexico, Canada, UK, all over Europe, parts of Asia, China, Japan, nothing from North Korea. After watching that North Collision in Korea special, which I'll be reviewing on the YouTube channel in the next day or two from Dark Side of the Ring, I can't say I've gotten a message from the Hermit Kingdom, but it blows me away because you don't think about that. And then to hear that there are people who in different time zones in different parts of the world who just sit down for 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever it may be, and they listen to the podcast and they watch the streams on YouTube. If they watch live, it could be 4 o'clock in the morning where they are, but they stay up or they super chat. It's awesome. It's a great feeling. And it makes all of the preparation and all the work and everything that goes into it completely worth it. It's not just that I sit down and plug a microphone in once a week and I record. There's a lot of work. It's very time consuming. There's expenses involved, but it's a lot of fun, and it has been very fulfilling for me. I enjoy it as much now as I did, you know, 14 years ago when I first started it. So, especially hearing from people like you, Raphael, I appreciate the support, and I appreciate your support. I hope you'll continue to email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter @solemonster. I have not yet recorded my Dark Side of the Ring review from Thursday's show, but I will be doing that probably when I'm done here. I'll be doing that, and so watch for that on YouTube. This is Warrior Week coming up. We got the Ultimate Warrior A&E biography is tonight, and they interviewed his widow, Dana, and the Warrior kids. So that's going to be airing on A&E, and that'll certainly be one perspective tonight. And then this Thursday is the Dark Side of the Ring episode on the Ultimate Warrior, and they got his ex-wife, I think his first wife, they interviewed her for the special. So that'll be an interesting take that we have not heard before. And I don't know who else they got for it, but It's Warrior Week, and I'll have a review on all of that probably next weekend. So that's something to look forward to. And again, I'm going to be live on YouTube this Wednesday. Even though Dynamite is not airing, it is being preempted until Friday. I'll be live on YouTube at 8 p.m. Eastern. If that changes, I will let you guys know on Twitter. But mark it down, 8 p.m. Eastern time, Wednesday night, live on YouTube. We're going to be going through all of the Double or Nothing matches for next Sunday's pay-per-view. I will give my predictions on each and every single one of them. And then taking your super chats, your calls, your questions. So I will see you then. And of course, next weekend for episode 706. It is Memorial Day weekend coming up next weekend. And Double or Nothing on pay-per-view next Sunday. Be live on YouTube after that as well. So a lot of good stuff coming up. Thank you to all my new YouTube members. I got more content coming your way as well. The work never ends. Be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. And I will see you guys for more Sound Off all throughout the week and again next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Salamonster Sounds Off.
The great Kali. When I think back to all those Kali moments, I mean, we've got the there was the time that he, who can forget that great, you know, how about I just share a story? Big Show sees Kali walk in. He says, "Hey, motherfucker, why do you keep stealing my spots? That's bullshit. You can't even do any of it properly anyway because you're the fucking shits."
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter @Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.